If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts. From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars. Today, we bring our series on Gibson versus Fender to a close. We followed the fathers of modern electric guitar through decades of groundbreaking innovation. And even though they've both hit some bad notes over the years, Gibson and Fender are still here today, trying to court new generations of guitar players and keep the old ones. But music has changed a lot since legendary rockers like Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones dominated the airwaves, and the electric guitar is not quite the king of instruments that it used to be. Here to tell us about Gibson, Fender, and the guitar's place in the music we hear today is rock music critic Ian Port. Ian is the author of The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll. The book highlights the intense rivalry between Fender and Gibson, and no surprise, Ian is a guitar player himself. Ian Port, welcome to Business Wars. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been a music critic for about 15 years. I'm thinking you've been a music fan for considerably longer. What made you decide to hone in on these characters and this rivalry when it came to writing your own book?
Well, I just thought that, you know, their story was so consequential. It had shaped so much about the way that music sounds and looks and feels. And their stories were so compelling, that backstory of these instruments just really drew me in. And these two guys, their crazy lives.
You know, you got Gibson on the one hand, Fender on the other, both obviously still maybe the biggest names in the business, the guitar business. But Gibson has a bit further to go to get back on top. They went into a Chapter 11 bankruptcy back last October. Why is Gibson having such a hard time compared with Fender?
Well, I think Gibson made a couple rough business calls back in you know, the late 2000s, in terms of trying to turn themselves into a kind of sonic music lifestyle company, acquiring consumer electronics brands like Philips and things like that. And I think, you know, overall, there's a perception in the community of musicians, whether it's true or not, that the quality of Gibson guitars has become at best inconsistent and at worst poor. And, you know, they still have quite high prices. So it's a kind of become a tougher value proposition, whereas Fender is a bit more flexible, targeted more toward a younger audience, I would say, and certainly offers a wider range of more affordable models.
That's interesting. You know, you talk about Gibson's strategy. Let's focus on the guitars for just a minute, because I think that that alone was rather telling. At the end of the aughts, I guess, you know, like 2009, maybe even 2011, Gibson seemed to be coming out with a lot of really odd guitars. And it sort of reminded me of an earlier chapter in the Gibson-Fender rivalry, you know, back in the 50s after the Stratocaster came out, and it was so far ahead of the curve, just in terms of the body style, you know, if nothing else. Gibson tried to catch up with models like the Flying V and the Explorer. And then fast forward to 2010, Fender is in the lead, and Gibson comes out with some really odd guitars with a lot of unusual electronics built in. Later, they come out with a guitar that in a way is like a modern-day Flying V in at least two ways. It's a bizarrely shaped rocket-style guitar, and nobody wants to touch it. In the same way that that 1958 Flying V, nobody wanted to touch that either. So I wonder, was Gibson just ahead of the curve, or was it just trying to do too much, do you think?
I think that it miscalculated a little bit about how open its audience would be to those kind of technological advances in both times. I mean, I think, you know, certainly the Flying V was a very radical guitar for 1958, and the other models that came out with it then were too. But I think that today, a lot of people who play electric guitar are not necessarily looking for, you know, their guitar to be this kind of center, this sort of totem of modern technology with like all kinds of electronic doodads and things that can go wrong and things that kind of define it as being very different from the original guitars that everyone wants and would love to buy if they could afford them. And it just seems like a big miscalculation on Gibson's part to put so much emphasis on up-to-the-moment technology rather than a kind of classic heritage.
A lot of criticism fell on Henry Juskowitz, who is the outgoing chief executive officer, who retains a certain connection with Gibson, at least in a consultatory role of some sort. What's your impression so far of Gibson's new CEO, and do you think he's on the right track?
I would have said he was on the right track until fairly recently. You know, I was at Gibson's exhibit at NAMM this year, the big music instrument trade show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reaction there was overwhelmingly positive. Gibson had its models sort of lined up in a way that made sense. They had sensible features. They had great colors. The line was sort of simplified from the kind of huge, sprawling, complex product lines they'd offered in previous years. And, you know, the new guy was there and he was giving interviews and he seemed to be kind of on the ball and have a real clear sense of what was going to help restore the company's reputation in the minds of players. Lately, you know, Gibson has come out and has sort of pursued a legal strategy against other companies that have made Gibson-like guitars mm-hmm. and have been making them for a long time. And mm-hmm. Gibson has pursued trademark infringement or said it's going to pursue trademark infringement cases against these companies. And I think, you know, the reaction to that has been, again, kind of overwhelmingly negative from the community. It's just like, this isn't a way to kind of boost the Gibson brand. This makes them look bad.
Just a couple of things that we should probably say, perhaps in Gibson's defense, but I think in all fairness, these lawsuits, they were initiated, not the lawsuits themselves, but the groundwork for them back in the Henry Juskowitz era. They were going after these alleged copyright infringements. And what we're talking about here, if you've ever seen that iconic Flying V shape, a lot of other guitar makers, including Dean Guitars, have come out with similar wild-shaped guitars. And if Gibson doesn't chase down those who have been using these designs, by default, won't they lose their ability to enforce everything that all their intellectual property? I mean, that's something that you can't let other companies exploit, even if you're not trying to make a whole lot of money off of lawsuits.
It's a complex question in the world of electric guitars. You know, back in, I think, 2005, Gibson sued the Paul Reed Smith Company for releasing a guitar that looked very much like the Les Paul model. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul Reed Smith guitars already had a sort of similarity to the Les Paul in terms of their construction a little bit. And this one looked very much like a Les Paul from the silhouette alone. It went all the way to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. It actually ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said no. And, you know, Gibson lost the lawsuit against Paul Reed Smith for making this. So that's just one of several legal cases that I'm aware of that show that it's very difficult to trademark and defend a body mm-hmm. style. Now, when yeah. you're talking about the headstock shape on the guitar, that can be a different story. And I believe Gibson has defended that successfully in the past. But guitar body shapes, and especially ones that have been around for decades, seems to be a bit of an uphill battle.
Again, this seems to echo, though, a certain theme. Going back to even our first and second episodes in our series, we were talking about how Les Paul was playing this non-resonant guitar called the Log. He called it the Log because it didn't have any resonator holes, and he could put a pickup in there, and it wouldn't feed back, which was the problem with trying to amplify old-style Spanish guitars. So he had figured out a solution with his Log. Leo Fender saw it at an informal jam session, and lo and behold, he takes the concept and turns it into one of the biggest guitar companies in the world. I mean, there's always been that sort of, shall we say, borrowing some of the best ideas in this business?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always been borrowing. You know, Leo Fender was borrowing from steel guitar makers like Rickenbacker and from people like Paul Bigsby, and certainly borrowing, you know, some ideas from Les Paul. I don't how much he took from the log is unclear, but he definitely took a lot from other people like Paul Bigsby. And so, yeah, that's kind of just how it goes in the world. And, you know, it's interesting, Leo Fender himself, from what I've the research I've done, had a pretty interesting sort of funny attitude when confronted with foreign copies of his guitars, which he first saw in, I believe, the 70s or the 80s. Mm-hmm. He was kind of flattered by them. He was kind of flattered that these Japanese factories had copied his designs right down to the very screw hole.
Well, let's turn to Fender then. What do you think has kept him on top of the industry all these years? I guess they are, in a sense, cheaper to make than many Gibsons.
They are. And it's important to note that, you know, Fender had a long period in the wilderness, too, in the later years of its ownership by CBS. Fender went through a very rough patch, you know, severely damaged its reputation among players, and had to spend a long time kind of rehabilitating it throughout the 1980s. Since then, I think that what's kept them on top is... it's a lot of things, but it's price. I think Fender's been able to make attractive guitars at reasonable prices. I think, especially more recently, Fender has done a good job of kind of inserting itself into the way music culture looks and feels now. It has, you know, people of color and women in its ads and in its sort of marketing materials. You get the sense that Fender isn't demanding that you play a certain kind of music with its guitars. It just wants you to kind of express yourself with them. And, you know, that's a bit froofy, but that is the sort of message sent by its marketing. And I think that goes a long way.
That's the marketing side of things, of course. Something else that strikes me is that Fender also sort of does the whole range. When you think about the fact that Fender makes amplifiers, and not just amplifiers, but world-class amplifiers. Gibson's tried to make amplifiers, but none have ever had the sort of longevity or the buzz that Fender's amps have had. That's got to be a huge boost to the Fender bottom line.
Yeah, it must be. And, you know, Fender started out essentially as an amplifier company. That
right.
was like, you know, Leo Fender started building radios, and then he went to, you know, fixing and then building amplifiers. So that was where kind of their original expertise lay. And, you know, the Fender amplifier has been definitive in terms of that landscape. So, you know, I think that's kind of another factor for people is it's like, oh, you're going to have a Fender amp. Well, maybe get a Fender guitar to go through it and they're going to sound great together. And, you know, again, for what you get with a Fender amplifier, they're reasonably priced for most people.
We should probably point out, I mentioned just offhand that Fenders are cheaper to make than Gibsons. Maybe we should just explain that. Fenders are basically, for the most part, if you're talking about a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, almost two-piece instruments. You have a body and a neck and some bolts and sometimes some springs, right?
Yep, exactly. Two pieces of wood, you can bolt them right together. You know, the finishing is much less sort of demanding than Gibson, because a lot of Fenders have a solid kind of one color paint job instead of, you know, Gibson has those beautiful transparent finishes that take a lot of time and manpower to make. And, you know, unlike Gibson, Fender guitars are made in Asia, they're made in Mexico, and they're made in the U.S., whereas a Gibson guitar is only made in the U.S., and, you know, that also makes them considerably more expensive to produce.
And, you know, the Fenders that are made in Mexico and in Japan, and indeed the Chinese Squires, which are sort of the sub-brand for Fender, they're pretty darn good guitars. I can remember growing up, and it was, you know, if you were going to buy a Fender or a Gibson, you're going to spend anywhere from $800 to $1,000, sometimes much, much, much more. These days, you can get a guitar at least of that quality for sometimes $300, $350. It's kind of amazing.
An amazing leap has been made in the last sort of decade or two, especially with the like really lowest end guitars. I mean, even the lowest Squire line, which I think, you know, you can get a Squire instrument for $200 or less off the shelf in a store. It's pretty darn nice. Sounds pretty good, you know, and the baseline Fenders that I think are now, let's say $600 or so, $500 with the Fender name. They're made in Mexico, but they're beautiful, you know. When Eric Clapton's family gave him one as a gift, he still plays the thing. That's how good they are.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers.
Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. Have you heard about this new line out of the Mexico factory for Fender? I think it begins with a V.
I think it's a Vintera.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. What do you think of those? They look sort of like pawn shop guitars with some pretty vibrant colors. What are they doing there?
You know, I think it's, again, there's kind of this, the base urge for so many guitar players is to kind of get one of the originals, right? And the originals are worth tens of thousands. And this is a way to kind of provide some of the appeal of the original, the style of the original, and hopefully we'll see maybe the sound of the original at a much, much lower price point.
And on the Gibson side, we should point out the Epiphones, which are the budget line for Gibsons. They're no slouch. You can buy a nice Epiphone for, I don't know, $500 or $600. And honestly, most people would not know the difference. You'd have to be a really expert player to be able to tell the difference in a lot of cases. The finish is just so good. So you take those ideas, put them together, and this should be a new golden age for electric guitar. But it's not. I mean, we've been hearing about a lot of folks not wanting to buy guitars anymore. What's happening?
Well, I think, you know, music has changed a lot. I mean, music is always changing a lot, but it's changed in the last 10 or 15 years in a way that has definitely kind of removed the electric guitar from the center of things. You know, so much of the way music is made now is about electronic production, sampling, and things that are done on the computer, on software like, you know, Logic and Ableton and all of these different software instruments that people have now. And that's made the guitar sort of, in some ways, less central to music performance. But, you know, I always have to push back a little bit against this notion that the guitar doesn't matter as much. I think if you look at any kind of live musical presentation, whether it's a big concert or an award show or even watching Beyoncé's Homecoming, there are guitar solos everywhere. You know, there are front performers, whether they're male or female, picking up a guitar and strumming it and holding it, you know, on Saturday Night Live. They're still there. They're still everywhere. And they are still in the music, too, even if not quite in the same way as they are in the past. But it's definitely receded from visibility a little bit.
Yes. You know what does seem to be missing, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it used to be that there were guitar heroes. There was Jimmy Page, and there was Jeff Beck, and of course Les Paul was in some respects the original, you know, guitar hero. All of these players are associated with specific types of guitars. And then you fast forward to today, and I wonder if the missing link is that star, you know? Today, you thumb through Guitar Player magazine, and we're still celebrating the heroes of the 60s and 70s, the classic rock heroes. Who are today's guitar heroes? And don't you think there'd be a whole lot more guitars sold if there were people looking at those heroes and saying, I want that?
I do. I mean, I think there are actually a lot of guitar heroes out there right now. I mean, one I would point to immediately is St. Vincent.
Oh, yeah.
She's an amazing rocker and has her own custom Music Man model. And, you know, it has been on everything everywhere and you know, tours huge venues around the world. She's a great player. You know, a couple players that I like in the kind of Americana country realm are, you know, Jason Isbell and Sturgill Simpson, both of whom are aspiring guitar heroes if they're not there. I think part of what we're talking about here is that, you know, the musical landscape has changed so much and become so fractured that there aren't quite musical stars now that penetrate all sort of levels of the culture in the way that there used to be. So there are musicians out there making great music and putting the guitar front and center with great playing, but they just, because the musical landscape is so fractured, they don't quite have the wide audience that they may have in years past.
So this series in your book focuses on the evolution of the guitar, and the electric guitar was created because, well, they needed to keep up with the trumpets, the trombones, when jazz became popular, and the electric guitars we've been talking about were the result of an attempt to try to control the feedback. So as you look at the landscape today, what are guitar makers doing right now that seem to be pushing the boundaries in that same way that Gibson and Fender pushed the boundaries back in the 50s and 60s? Do you see any? I mean, I notice you mentioned Paul Reed Smith, for example, and they certainly seem to be pushing boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, the way that I see it the most is in amplifier designs.
Huh.
You know, amplifier technology has come so far, and that was such a huge part of this story that is a little harder to explain and a little harder to show to the kind of regular person. But, you know, as the quality of sound reproduction has gotten better and cheaper and lighter and smaller, there's just so much more you can do with a small amplifier, such a variety of sounds you can get out now, especially with, you know, microprocessors and digital modeling technology. That kind of leads into as well the kind of technology that's been put onto computers. In the old days, you couldn't plug an electric guitar into the mixing board of a studio.
Uh-huh.
You could. It just wouldn't sound that good because the amplifier kind of completes the circle. It gives the guitar the warmth, the voice, the character, the distortion, the reverb, whatever it is, that magical quality. That comes from the amplifier, or it came from the amplifier. But now, you can have, you know, software plugins on your computer. You can plug your guitar straight into the computer, and it'll go through that patch of software, and you can make it sound like any set of amplifiers and microphones and rooms and reverbs and effects pedals you want, and record that directly on to the computer as well. So the amplifier, you know, is almost going to become, I think, a redundant step.
You think that's going to translate into performance? I mean, that makes a lot of sense from a studio standpoint.
I think that if you look at the way guitar is actually performed on stage, basically it's someone holding a guitar and it's running into a bank of digital processors anyway.
Yeah.
It's already there.
Yeah, yeah. So we touched on this, but I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. You don't think the guitar is going away. So what about Fender and Gibson? Are they here to stay? Are they here for the long haul? Can they survive the fracturing of the music landscape?
I think so. Yes, I think Fender is in a good position. It's doing as much as it can to sort of stay relevant. I think Gibson definitely has a little bit of ways to go there and a way to kind of figure out how it can seem fresh and new and, you know, of the moment, but also satisfy, you know, the kind of vision and dreams that of its kind of classic rock heritage, right? So that's the kind of challenge that Gibson has. But I don't think these companies are going away. I mean, Gibson's been around since, like, I think 1894.
Mm-hmm.
They've weathered a lot of changes in music, and I have faith that they'll be able to do that. I think it's just a matter of figuring out, you know, what kind of product line it makes sense to offer in the kind of bizarre, you know, musical landscape that we have now. And I think, you know, we should be clear, too, that this is a time when almost everyone in the entire music industry is trying to figure out, what are we doing? Where is this going? How are we going to make money? You know, from your artists to your record labels to your music journalism publications, everyone is kind of scratching, trying to find a solution to all these changes that we've been going through with technology in the last two decades. So the fact that guitar makers have been caught a little bit off guard by them, I don't think is a sign of bad things for their longevity.
You want to have some fun?
Yeah.
All right. You're going to have to be honest with me here now, Ian.
Oh, no.
Desert Island guitar time.
Oh.
You've got one guitar. You got one guitar that you can take to that desert island. And I'll let you have an amp, too, so that'll broaden the the choices. And some electricity. We'll have to put some electricity on this island. What you going to take? You going to take a Gibson or a Fender or something else?
If I could take any guitar,
yeah.
I would take a Fender Stratocaster, 1962.
Why 62?
And there's something about those early 60s Stratocasters. You know, they were put out before Leo left, back when the factory was operating at huge volumes, kind of when Fender had a little bit more of its quality control act together. They came in really cool colors. They had rosewood fretboards. And, you know, I've played them, and they sound amazing. They just sound so good. And for an amp, I'd probably take a Marshall Plexi half stack, just like Jimi Hendrix played.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
What about you?
You know, I want to say that I would go with like a Flying V or an Explorer, because honestly, I'm of that age, let's just say. I mean, my heroes were the guys that were rocking those Explorers and the Flying Vs. It's funny because it's hard for me to imagine a time when those things wouldn't sell, because to me, that was, you know. But at the end of the day, I've played them. You know, I've tried to put a Flying V in my lap, and as you know, Ian, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And the Explorer is clumsy, you know, to play. It's just that huge body, right? And
yep.
And I keep gravitating back to the Les Paul, because I think of Paul Kossoff in Free. And I loved that sound that he got. And I think he was using a Marshall Plexi, if I'm not mistaken. It is, to me, it's the defining sound of rock and roll. And really, it's a defining sound of like that 70s rock and roll. But here's the irony. Which guitar can I play the best? Hands down, it's a stupid Fender Telecaster. And I say stupid because, you know, I see a Telecaster and I see, as you were describing earlier, this two pieces of wood. It's not the thing that I associate with rock and roll. I associate it with country music. And yes, there have been a lot of great rock players who have played it. But
it's
that basicness that, you know, I like the flash. I like that glam element. And that's why I keep kind of going toward the Gibson. So I don't know, man. I don't know. It'd probably have to be a white Gibson Les Paul custom. And I'm with you on the Plexi. I'd go with that, too.
You have a lot of fun on a desert island with that setup.
I think we both could. Maybe we could find a drummer or something and put together a band. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, this Ian, you made it a lot of fun. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on Business Wars. Ian Port is the author of The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll. He's also a music critic and a guitar player himself. It's been a lot of fun, Ian. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. That was my conversation with Ian Port, rock music critic and author of The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll. Next time on Business Wars, we're taking you all the way back to the 1800s for a battle that's more than just a two-player rivalry. It's an all-out war with multiple players you've definitely heard of before. You may even have their names sitting on boxes in your pantry right now. Stay tuned for our next series, The Cereal Wars. But be careful, it's going to snap, crackle, and pop a few times before we get through. Thanks so much for listening to Business Wars. New episodes come out every Monday and Wednesday. Business Wars is hosted by yours truly, David Brown. This episode was produced by Caitlin Plummer. Mixing by Bay Area Sound. Lee Hernandez is our special episodes producer. Karen Lowe is the senior editor and producer of Business Wars. Jenny Lauer Beckman is our editor and producer. The executive producer is Marshall Louie. Our program was created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.